This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the middle of September, and this week the House of Representatives has been working on that reconciliation spending package that's been the key source of debate within the Democratic Party for weeks. This process is one big math problem. Democrats have committed that what they spend will need to be paid for, and we learned a lot this week about two of the biggest pay-fors. Democrats in the House have a plan to raise taxes and are debating how to lower the prices the government pays for prescription drugs in Medicare. But there are big sticking points on both. House Democrats seek to raise taxes on corporate income, on capital gains for high earners, and they want to impose a new surtax on all personal income over $5 million. But these tax increases fall well short of what the Biden administration has proposed. On pharma, there is a handful of moderate Democrats who've been resisting a plan to negotiate drug pricing down. They say it's going to stifle innovation. Plus, there are the cliffs. The government runs out of money to operate on September 30, and unless it's raised, we're going to hit the federal debt limit sometime in October or November. Democrats are working with Republicans on a bipartisan government funding bill, but they don't have an agreement yet. And Republicans are turning up the heat, saying Democrats will have to raise the debt ceiling on their own while they try to do all the rest of this spending. To talk about where that leaves the Biden administration's big domestic policy plans, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Tim Carney, senior political columnist at the Washington Examiner and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute on the right. Hello, Tim.
Good to be here, Josh.
And on the left, David Dayan, executive editor at the American Prospect. Hello, David.
Thanks for having me.
David, you were expressing frustration last week about the sort of submerged nature of the tax fight. You had some Democratic moderates whose real concern about this package, or their biggest concern, was that it was going to raise taxes too much on certain kinds of corporations or wealthy people. Now we have that fight out in the open, but it already looks like there's been a significant retrenchment away from some of those tax increases.
Yeah, absolutely. The big thing that also was missing from the Ways and Means package, which had all the taxes in it, was this change to step up in basis, which is a wonky way of saying that capital gains don't get realized when somebody dies. They assume the people who inherit the money get it, get those assets at the level that they were at, and they
It basically means if you own an asset that's risen in value and you die holding it, that appreciation, it never gets taxed. You don't pay tax on it. Your heirs don't pay tax on it. It's as though the income never happened.
Exactly. And the idea behind the Biden plan was to realize those gains at death, and that was completely missing from the Ways and Means package. My view is that however we get to the number that we want to get to, and the Ways and Means package did raise well over $2 trillion from taxes, however they get there, if you care about taxing the rich, maybe you care that, you know, they were assembled in a certain way or another. If you care about the social spending and you see these things as linked, because that's how they have been, the spending and the revenue needing to be offset, then whatever gets you there, in my view, is fine. But there are problems with the level in the House, and there are bigger problems in the Senate, where I think even some of the House measures are going to be looked upon disfavorably. So then you get into this sort of this bargaining session with yourself, where you say, okay, well, what can we handle on the spending side? What can we jettison? Can we do more with less? And it's this really frustrating, I think, for activists and liberals, negotiation with oneself that really demobilizes people about this bill, despite the advances it might make.
Tim, as David notes, this fairly wonky sounding but actually pretty important provision about step up in basis at death. They're not going to try to change it as part of this package. What is the conservative case for the law as it exists there? I mean, I understand there are the various reasons that conservatives don't like estate taxes and the idea that, you know, once income has been taxed once, you shouldn't tax it again. But that's not what's happening here. This is income that gets taxed zero times. You are able to hold on to stock or to a business or to a piece of real estate until your death, and then all of the rise in the value of that, which is income to you, you can live off of it, you can even borrow against it and use it to support your standard of living, and wealthy people people do this routinely. Why should we have a tax code structured such that income is taxed not twice, not one time, but zero times?
Well, first of all, Biden's proposal was not to, take the original basis of the stock and tax your capital gains according to that. It was to have a new inheritance tax, sort of on top of, underneath, whatever you want to call the current estate tax, which has a very large exemption. This was to say when you inherit the thing, you have to pay taxes on it. He wasn't getting rid of this, loophole. As you could consider it, he was just sort of smashing it with a giant new estate inheritance tax hammer. The argument for it is, and I was calling around people and asking about it, because it does seem that if you're going to pay capital gains tax, it should be from what your original price basis was, and then you subtract that from the final value, and that's your gain, right? Well, one argument is that any capital gains tax that doesn't account for inflation, if it's something that's held for over 40 years, is going to basically be taxing you for inflation, for something to the degree to which it preserved its value. Second is that some of these things that are passed down are, a small business. You have no idea. I was talking to my old tax guy, and he said, I don't know what the original basis of my tax business is. So if I pass that to my children, we don't know how to measure that. But ultimately, there was a middle ground, which Biden chose not to pursue, which was to say, yeah, when you finally sell this thing and you finally realize the gains, the basis should be, what your mom paid for that stock 50 years ago. It shouldn't be what it was when you inherited it 10 years ago. Biden didn't go that route.
David, and as Tim notes there, there is this other option, which is that you could have carried over the basis, which is to say, and you had former Senator Heidi Heitkamp running around Capitol Hill talking about, it'll force liquidation of these businesses because the kids will inherit it and then they'll have to pay tax on it. But it's not like it threw off a bunch of cash immediately to pay the tax unless you liquidate or sell a portion of the business. And I think the people making that case were sort of overstating the frequency with which that happens in very sympathetic cases. But you can get around that anyway, which is that you could do what Tim said, that basically instead of saying you tax it at death, you just say, well, we'll continue to build up the capital gain. And when you eventually sell it, then you have to pay tax. And that encourages people to sell because if unlike the system now where delaying means that eventually you don't have to pay the tax at all, if you're on the hook sooner or later, it encourages people to sell sooner. But I think one reason that they didn't go that direction has to do with the weirdness of the way the budget process works, which is that when you're writing a bill like this, you get credit for revenue that is raised within the next 10 years. If the revenue is 11 years from now, you get no credit for it whatsoever. And the system that Tim describes there, it doesn't raise that much less money in the long run, but it raises quite a bit less money in the first 10 years. And it feels like, again, that is a logical, certainly a logical political middle ground. It would be a significant policy improvement from what we have now, but it's yet another thing that you don't do because it's not rewarded by the rules of the budget process.
Yeah, and you always have to do these very convoluted things to sort of game this system that Congress itself set up. So, I mean, they could actually just change the system, but instead they find loopholes around the system and the manacles that they put upon themselves. The other example is delaying the start date of something. And so, for example, the dental benefit in Medicare wouldn't start till 2028 under the auspices of this bill. And that means that you only have 3 years of the spending within the budget window. But of course, it goes on beyond that. We live beyond a 10-year time frame. And it just looks like less money is spent within that budget constraint that you have. So there are all kinds of ways to sort of game this system that are suboptimal for policy. With respect to step-up basis, however, my understanding is what was initially in the bill was this provision that if you kept the business within your family, that you could spend, I believe you could spread out to 15 years the time that you would need to pay that tax. So there was an accommodation made for small businesses, for family farms. However, the very prodigious Democratic lobbyists who were opposed to doing any changes to this eventually won the day.
I want to turn and talk about drug prices. There's this dispute basically over whether Medicare should directly negotiate the drug prices that are paid under Medicare plans that effectively reduce the price that gets paid for pharmaceuticals. It would save hundreds of billions of dollars, again, over this budget window. And so, David, you have strong views on this, and this is foundered so far on opposition from certain Democrats in the House, although they have further opportunities to add this to the bill. Is there a logical place for this to end up as a compromise? Because I know with the corporate tax, it's like, you know, some Democrats say 25, some say 28. You can end up at 26 and a half. Is there a way to square this circle so that you have some additional negotiation of drug prices that wins over some of the Democrats who are recalcitrant about that? Is there a middle way on this?
Well, interestingly, there was a compromise being forged between the House and Senate. That was the deal. And that compromise was not over whether or not Medicare should be allowed to negotiate prescription drug prices. This is something that Democrats have run on since the six in 06. It was their 2006 strategy for winning the House of Representatives. They've literally been running on this for 15 years. It's incredibly popular. 90% of the public agrees with this. So that's not the issue. The issue has been in the details, how you actually do this. How many drugs are eligible for negotiation? What kinds of drugs are eligible for negotiation? What is the reference price? So when you sit down for the negotiation, what is Medicare going to say? This is what we want this to be pegged to. On the House side, it was an index of six industrialized nations and what they pay for prescription drugs. On the Senate side, it's a domestic index based mainly on what the VA pays. And the VA pays less for prescription drugs than Medicare, but more than international rates. So you could see a potential compromise there. But what we have now is these three House Democrats, Kurt Schrader of Oregon, Scott Peters of California, and Kathleen Wright of New York, who have completely obliterated the House side of the negotiation by opposing this and showing in their show of force, even though House managers could put it back in the bill at some point, they're showing that they would oppose the bill if you put this level in. And of course, their compromise is even further to the side of allowing more prescription drug companies to keep their profits because they would only negotiate on Medicare on drugs that are off patent. So that would maintain the patent monopoly for companies that have no competition and can charge whatever they want for a period of time. So that's where there is a kind of way to get this done, but it looks very much like it's going to be something in the Senate, and it may have to be a compromise between what's in the Senate and now what these three House Democrats are wanting.
And so that means less savings, presumably, in the end.
It means less savings. It means higher prices for individuals, because not only Medicare patients would benefit from this, but commercial insurance payers would be able to access those rates. So it means more money for people paying for drugs. It means more profits for drug companies. And it means less money for the government, which can be used to offset other spending in this bill. So right. In my view, that's a lose-lose-lose for everybody involved, except for drug companies.
Tim, the extent to which drug companies are profitable is inherently a creation of public policy. I mean, it starts with the patent system. Congress decides how long these patents are going to last, what the nature of exclusivity is, and that sort of thing. So basically, the government has already built this structure that decides how profitable it's going to be to develop drugs. And then, of course, you also have, you know, the government is a payer through Medicaid, and there's already drug price restrictions in Medicaid. The government creates the structure of the private insurance market, which drives what payments will be. So ultimately, we've already made a series of public policy choices that drive how profitable pharmaceutical companies are. How do we know that the existing set of choices is the right choice? That it would be a bad thing if you had a change to the system that, as David describes here, would push prices down, reduce the return to drug development. The CBO does think this would cause a modest reduction in the amount of new drug development that happens. But I mean, this is always a balancing test, right? Between how much we're going to pay for drugs now versus how much profit incentive we're creating for the development of drugs later. Why are conservatives confident that this move is a move in the wrong direction on that balancing test?
Well, we could have gone on for the rest of the show talking about the government subsidies for drug makers. I mean, you didn't mention the ban on re-importing drugs. You didn't mention Obamacare's many subsidies for drug makers, requiring insurers to cover drugs and sometimes even more expensive versions of drugs. So the drug makers always win in Washington. And as you're pointing out, they are essentially they depend on mostly this short-term monopoly they get when they invent a drug, which is designed, it's mentioned in the Constitution, that if there's such high fixed costs to develop a drug and low marginal costs, it takes a penny to make this pill, that if you allowed free and open competition, then you would not have drug development. But that policy, which has been tinkered with, Hatch-Waxman was a rewrite of that. There have always been tinkering with sort of what is your period of exclusivity? How long do you get this monopoly to allow you to recapture your research and development to say, well, we need to funnel them a profit through this other method, which is that Medicare is going to buy a ton of your drugs and we're not going to negotiate it. That doesn't make sense to me. So I agree with David basically on this. And I think conservatives need to realize the drug makers are not their friends. Without pharma, big pharma lobby, Obamacare probably never would have passed. And thank God. I mean, I think Pfizer and Moderna are the only two heroes of the pandemic. The rest of us, I think, all look like cowards hiding in our closets. But that means that it was right to pay Pfizer and Moderna and all the other drug companies to make this drug. It doesn't mean it's right to find here and there other little ways to pad their profits. And I think conservatives who stand with pharma and with the pro-pharma Democrats are making a big mistake.
I want to zoom out a little bit to talk about the big picture with this plan and the way that these, I mean, this week we've been focused on the aspects that will pay for the additional spending that we've talked a lot about in previous weeks in this bill. And David, I keep checking in with you on the likelihood that this is actually going to become law. I want your thoughts on how this debt limit fight plays into that, because periodically, the Congress has to authorize that the government can borrow more money as the national debt gets bigger and bigger. And when government is divided, you end up with a bipartisan deal in order to do that. And now you have Republicans saying, well, Democrats, you're in charge. You handle that yourselves, which really looks to me like partly as a way to increase the squeeze during this spending bill process. That basically, if Democrats want to raise the debt limit by themselves, they're probably going to have to do it within this reconciliation package. And so they'll have to get an agreement within a matter of just a few weeks. What is the right strategy for Democrats here? Can they get agreement in good faith on this whole spending package, stick a debt limit increase in it, and get all of that done by, you know, sometime in the middle of next month?
There's also the money that needs to fund the government on an ongoing basis, the continuing resolution. Otherwise, the government's going to shut down on September 30th. So there's a cliff being created here. There's this reconciliation bill and this Biden agenda, which is very wrapped up in Democrats' political strategy. And then there's this absurd staring contest over the debt limit, which of course is already spending that has already been made and authorized by Congress, but we're just deciding whether or not we're going to meet our obligations and pay for it. It's the dumbest thing in the world. And then we also have to fund the government. So this does create a lot of difficulties for just the sequencing and ordering of this. And I'm sure that Mitch McConnell is sitting there extremely happy that Democrats are going to have this problem with one another. When he says, Democrats, why don't you take care of that debt limit yourself? You know, they did not put a debt limit increase into the instructions for reconciliation on this go-round. And so they would essentially have to scrap the reconciliation bill and pass some other budget resolution that accommodates that. So, you know, McConnell is being pretty clever here. He's trying to sort of dump the reconciliation bill by saying, well, no, you have to do reconciliation with the debt limit bill. And of course, they could rewrite it and maybe find its way in there in another fashion. But what he's trying to do is by putting out this fight over the debt limit, he's trying to stop this reconciliation, trying to stop the Biden agenda, which, of course, has been Mitch McConnell's kind of one go-to strategy, whether it was the Obama administration or the Biden administration. And it's a go-to strategy because it seems to work. Like, if you know, under the minority veto points that we have in our system of government, a very determined minority in the Senate under current rules that doesn't want to accommodate a president of the opposite party can do that. And that's what McConnell's game has always been.
Let's take a quick break. I'll be back with Tim Carney of the Washington Examiner and AEI and David Dayan of the American Prospect to talk about vaccine boosters. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, columnist for Insider. On the right is Tim Carney, senior political columnist at the Washington Examiner and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. On the left is David Dayan, executive editor at the American Prospect. An FDA staff report issued this week made no recommendation regarding wider administration of vaccine booster shots against COVID-19. Boosters are currently authorized for certain immunocompromised people, but other countries like Israel and, just announced this week, the United Kingdom are moving forward with boosters for broader swaths of the population. There's increasing data that immune protection wanes over time, especially in older people and especially in the case of the Pfizer and Johnson shots. But the magnitude of the decrease is a matter of dispute, and experts are divided on the provision of boosters. The World Health Organization has urged rich countries not to give booster shots before the end of this year in order to preserve supply for lower-income countries. The Biden administration announced earlier this year that boosters would begin in the U.S. next week, an announcement that appears to have precipitated the departure of two senior vaccine scientists at the FDA. To talk about the merits of boosters, we're joined now by Dr. Peter Chin Hong. Dr. Chin Hong is a professor and dean at the University of California, San Francisco Medical School and an infectious disease specialist. Hello, Dr. Chin Hong.
Hi, Josh. Thanks for having me on.
So what do we know about what the benefits and costs would be of providing booster shots more broadly to seniors or to the whole population?
So like with anything in life, there are pros and cons. I think the pros are pretty straightforward in terms of just giving the immune system a boost. The immune system has forgotten several months ago when it received that first signal that it should make antibodies. So giving it a few months later gives it a reminder. And then the idea is that these immune cells will then not only be produced, they'll probably linger for the long term. And that's the idea between not just the COVID vaccines, but several other vaccines we have, hepatitis B, HPV, et cetera.
And what are the costs?
Oh, yes, the costs, of course. So the costs are, of course, the fact that there are 80 million Americans still unvaccinated. So you get to a situation where you're super protecting one part of the population, another part isn't. So you're not really going to get around the idea of decreasing transmission because most of the transmission occurs in the folks not yet vaccinated. And of course, the other cost is the optics and the global viewpoint that we're giving 3-4 shots to some folks in this country. And there are many countries without even one shot going into someone's arm. So I think these are some of the potential costs.
You say potentially 4 shots. One thing I've been wondering as I've been following the news about the boosters is, I mean, I know there are a lot of vaccines that have a 3-shot sequence where you have 2 pretty close together and then 1 quite a bit farther apart, maybe 6 months out. That doesn't mean that you need a shot every 6 months. Do we have a sense if we go to a booster model, is it likely that people are going to need a 4th shot some number of months later, or is it going to be sort of 3 and done, or 3 and then maybe you don't need another shot for several years?
Well, it's hard to tell because when in those other shots, when you give 2 and then 1 a few months later, you're protecting, you're relying on T cells, which are kind of like the cells inside your body already, the immune cells. These antibodies are in some types of antibodies that reside in the mucosal area. So they're the first defense. And if they decline every 6 months, like many people predict will happen with COVID, it turns out that you may need more frequent boosters if you want to prevent infection. Your disease, which is prevented by the T cells, will probably remain intact for much longer because these are memory cells. So, you know, Israel already started preparing their population for a potential 4th shot. And then I think that's when a lot of people lost it, because is it going to be a situation where you're going to get a shot every 6 months if you really want to prevent infection, when no one after two shots so far, except for some populations, are going to get into trouble and going to the hospital?
Tim, I've been interested in watching this fight within the Biden administration and sort of a dispute between political appointees and career experts, because it's a theme that we saw a lot in the Trump administration. And there was this sort of, I think, simplistic idea of, you know, well, you know, do you listen to the experts or not? But you have a division among experts here, and then you also have differences, not just of views about the science, but differences of values. What is the purpose of the vaccines? Are they simply for preventing severe illness and death, or are they for returning society to normal and making it easier for people to do various public activities that create risk of spread? Is the proper focus of the U.S. government the welfare of the entire global population, or should they put a strong priority on people who are citizens of the United States? And so I think that it's been interesting to see with Trump removed from that calculus, I think a somewhat more sane conversation about what the role of experts is within this sort of policy decision making.
I think that's exactly right. We saw during the Trump era so much of the anti-Trump media, which is 99% of the media outside of Fox News, just say, well, trusting experts, you have to trust experts. And I had people say to me, public health should not be political. But the word public means it's got to be political. And what you were talking about there does have to do with values. And the job of the experts is to lay out and if then give us predictions, give us odds, tell us what the studies are, do the studies. But ultimately, in the end, it is going to come down to values. Experts could not tell us that it was worth locking down. They could say, this is what we think will happen if you lock down. But ultimately, that had to be up to us, which means our elected officials, the Democratic arm, has to do this. So the blind, let's all trust the experts and do everything they say, that you heard from, you know, somebody like Gretchen Whitmer or some leaders and a lot of people in the media, never made sense. Because as you're pointing out, there's always going to be values here. And Dr. Chin Hung, one of the interesting lines I saw from you in the New York Times was that symptomatic disease doesn't matter. You said, quote, I care about severe disease. Isn't that a difficult trade-off that we're not addressing at all? Are the third shots about making sure driving down case counts and possibly at the expense of driving down severe disease?
That's a great point, Tim. And of course, you know, I'm just sort of thinking where we are in the moment. I think everyone agrees at some point, and it may settle to a point where everyone will get a third shot. But it's really when you get the third shot is really the question, if at all, for some segments of the population. But you know, again, infection does have consequences too. A small proportion will get chronic symptoms. And it does, at the end, turn out to be something based on what society thinks is they're willing to tolerate to continue to live the lives that we all aspire to.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other trade-off in there is the extent to which vaccines are supposed to be a tool for restoring normal societal operation. I mean, I saw there was a quote about a month ago in one of the New York Times stories about the debate over boosters from Ellie Murray, who's an epidemiologist at Boston University. And she was basically saying, you know, the booster shot would provide some benefit, but you can get that benefit just as easily by wearing a mask or avoiding indoor dining and crowded bars. But I mean, a lot of people, they want to go to bars, they want to eat in restaurants, or they want to do other activities that create risk of spread. They want to go to church. They want their children in school with masks off. And so I think partly, and we're seeing this in the economic data, we're seeing the retrenchment that has been seen actually, especially in parts of the country that haven't been hit that badly by Delta, but you have a lot of conscientiousness, a lot of concern by members of the public in those parts of the country. And it is interfering with the return to normal. And it seems to me like that's another part of the booster conversation. If the boosters are part of the formula that gets us back to where we don't need to worry as much about infections, even if they're not infections that cause serious illness and death, there's some value in that. It has to go into a cost-benefit question, but I've sort of felt like a lot of the experts don't seem to be ascribing weight to that.
And one other point, Josh, is that, you know, I think that we're still ignoring the fact that, or maybe not bringing into conversation at this point, the fact that still 80 million individuals in America are not vaccinated, and that's really where the virus is circulating. So if you really want to go back to the life that we aspire to, we have to get more people vaccinated. And I think that is really going to be the secret sauce rather than...
But is that a trade-off?
Multiple. It is a trade-off for sure.
How isn't it? I mean, the people who aren't vaccinated have had the opportunity for months to get vaccinated, and we can impose policies as the administration is doing that seek to induce or require them to get vaccinated. I don't see how that trades off resources against the administration of boosters. Do we actually not have enough doses to do both at the same time?
I think we will. We have plenty of doses. In fact, there have been vaccines waiting in the wings too, you know, like Novavax. We haven't approved formally AstraZeneca in this country yet. That's still very effective. So I think there are plenty of doses. The question is, you know, when do we stop and what evidence there is yet? I mean, I guess the issue of timing isn't the fact that we won't do it at some point. It's the fact that we just don't know how long that third shot will last. And, you know, and then we'll have a better sense of benefit, risks and trade-offs in terms of, do you need to get a booster every so often? Does it really apply to one population versus the other? I think that data will come and probably won't even take that long to come. It's just that we don't have it right now.
David, what have you made of the administration's handling of this issue with what looks pretty clearly to me like a significant thumb on the scale, which has caused a fair amount of consternation in the health agencies? Have the politicals in the Biden administration been right to be pushing in the direction of boosters?
Well, I'm going to part with most pundit practice and say that I'm not an epidemiologist. And so I don't know how equipped I am to judge the value, relatively speaking, of boosters and certainly the political overlay that there is when you're talking about the Biden administration and wanting to protect the citizenry. But I do have a problem with talking about whether or not we should be giving a third shot for Americans here when we don't have a first shot to give in much of the developing world. I mean, I was on this show in February saying that we really have an urgent need to vaccinate everyone in the world because there's this danger that there might be more mutations if the virus is allowed to run wild through unvaccinated populations. And sure enough, that's what happened. I mean, in India, a variant emerged called the Delta variant, and that has been just this deadly nightmare in the United States and throughout the world. And I think the biggest risk to us here in America, while also saying I'm not an epidemiologist, I really feel the biggest risk to us is a mutation of the virus gestating in Asia or Africa or South America. And that argues for us not taking up vaccine supply globally with shot after shot in the U.S. Now, maybe we can offer half doses for boosters. Maybe we fold it into flu shots on an ongoing basis. I mean, there's certainly things we can talk about. But if we're going to do boosters, I would also say that we should be and should have been working as hard as possible to maximize manufacturing for the past couple years. And, you know, the Biden administration talked about waiving the intellectual property on these vaccines about 6 months ago, and they've done nothing about it. I fear that because we waited so long that we have this lack of supply, the supply shortage globally, even though we have enough doses in the U.S. And I really feel that the mutation risk is a greater risk than the dissipation risk. Now, I'm at some point blowing smoke because I'm saying this without having all of the facts, but I'm looking at the demonstrable reality of the Delta variant and how much bigger a problem that was than shots wearing off. That's the reality that we're in.
Dr. Chin Hong, what is the nature of that trade-off? I mean, obviously there are the manufacturing capacity, it has increased, but it is fixed on some time scale around the world. To what extent can doses that are present in the U.S. available for administration, if they're not being administered here, to what extent do they actually get shipped around the world? Because I know we've already wasted over 10 million doses in the United States. If we don't go in the direction of boosters, to what extent does that actually increase the number of vaccines that we're sending to other countries?
I think it will definitely add to the the supply abroad. But David is right. There are other things that we need to do, not just give physical vaccines. We have to give the recipe for the vaccines. We have to give the people, the cooks who can make the recipe. So the highly skilled individuals who know how to do work with the ingredients. We have to increase the supply of raw ingredients, which the Biden administration has vowed to do as well. But again, there's a lot of stalling. But yes, in terms of physical shots, we're probably not going to, we're probably like a thimble in a beaker. We're probably not going to, with our supply, really conquer the world, but we could certainly add and alleviate, maybe in some countries, and do it in a phased way. Countries that are undergoing surges, who don't have a lot of vaccines, we can prioritize those. We can prioritize countries where there's a lot of travel with from countries to out of the country, for example, to the US or elsewhere. There are many ways to think about this. And like David said, you can think about reducing the dose. Moderna, for example, gave almost like a double dose almost in their vaccine. So they're thinking about maybe halving the dose as a booster. So there are other things that you can think about. But regardless of how you splice and dice the pie, David is right. Every 2 weeks, there's a new variant being created. And the media is ripe with some of the newer ones like Mu and Lambda and Delta Plus and Kappa and Iota. I mean, we're going to run out of Greek alphabets pretty soon.
There's a sort of odd aspect to this policy debate over who should get boosters, which is that the vaccines are out there. They're in doctors' offices. They're in CVS stores. And ordinarily, when a pharmaceutical is approved, doctors have flexibility to prescribe and administer it in ways other than what the FDA has officially recommended. You can do off-label prescribing. And in practice, there's a lot of that happening out there. There are people who are going and getting booster shots that aren't within the existing pretty narrow recommendations about who should get boosters. You had Katty Kay from the BBC and David Leinhart from the New York Times talking about how Katty Kay got the Johnson & Johnson shot, and she said a senior health official told her that, you know, it really would be a good idea for her to get a booster of an mRNA vaccine, of a Pfizer or Moderna shot, but wouldn't say that on television. It's not the official recommendation, but I think this is something that I've personally heard about a lot of people doing. And I wonder what you make of that as a physician. I mean, as people look at this individually, they're not making public policy. They're making decisions about their own personal health. It seems like a lot of people have perfectly good reason to go out and say, well, I'm going to go get this booster, even though the FDA hasn't told me to.
Exactly, Josh. So there, you know, therein lies the difference or the discrepancy between a public health recommendation and an individual recommendation. And, you know, there are certain circumstances in an individual that may make it so that that person may want to get an additional shot outside of any guidance. For example, if you're working in a risky environment, say you're a utility worker and you got a J&J vaccine, it makes sense that if you're going into people's homes for a long, long time and you have a bunch of under 12-year-olds at home and you're a frontline worker or essential worker, that person might benefit from something because of their individual circumstance. But that's also something that's happening. You're right. A lot of off-label use. In fact, the Department of Public Health in San Francisco permissively allowed folks who received a J&J shot to get an additional shot after discussion with their healthcare provider.
Dr. Peter Chin Hong of the University of California, San Francisco Medical School, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Josh.
Before we take a break, it's KCRW's good old-fashioned pledge drive, and the way it works is simple. If you listen, you've got to give. So call us at 800-600-KCRW or go to kcrw.com/give. Are you a longtime listener but you've never donated? You know who you are. You can end your guilty streak right now, and you'll be glad you did, because we've been member-fueled for over 40 years. It's listeners like you who keep independent media alive by doing your part. So please give now. I want to thank just a few LRC listeners who have supported the station so far. That's Michael in Los Angeles, Catherine in Irvine, Lynn in Santa Monica, Megan in LA, Sandra in San Jose, Michael in London, and Philippe in Belgium. Thank you, Philippe. Thank you all so much. And when you give, pick up one of our Left, Right, and Center hats. They're baseball caps. They have civilized yet provocative embroidered right on the front. And feel free to leave a comment so I can thank you personally on the show. You can see all the other member perks, bonuses, and more at kcrw.com/give. Your support is so important, and we're so grateful because you make our work possible. And thank you. I've been talking with Tim Carney of the Washington Examiner and David Dayan of the American Prospect. We will be back to talk about the California recall. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow, columnist for Insider. On the right is Tim Carney, senior political columnist at the Washington Examiner and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. On the left is David Dayan, executive editor at the American Prospect. Gavin Newsom will continue to serve as governor of California. The polls in the recall were close for a while, but by the end they were not close, and neither were the results. With about 74% of the votes counted on Thursday, no to recall was leading by a 64-36 margin. Now, that's likely to shift a little. The late votes will be a bit different than the earlier votes, but the broad strokes are clear. The recall lost, and badly. Republicans in California had rallied around talk show host Larry Elder, a hard right candidate who was good for riling up Trump conservatives, but particularly ill-suited to appealing to the liberal California electorate, even if some non-conservative California voters had grown a little bit weary of Newsom. David, was this outcome inevitable, that sooner or later it wouldn't just be conservatives who are paying attention to the recall and the enthusiasm gap would diminish and California's strong partisan lean was just always going to reassert itself?
I think at some level it was inevitable. I think the moment when a state judge put Larry Elder back on the ballot because the Secretary of State had actually disqualified him for problems with his tax returns, that was the moment that Gavin Newsom won the recall, because it was very hard for Newsom prior to that to put a face to this recall effort. There was one ad that went out that had shots of Mike Huckabee and Newt Gingrich as if they are these huge boogeymen for California voters. But Elder allowed Newsom to sort of make that direct connection to Trump, frankly, that this is someone with very particular extreme views. He had a long history, had a long record on the radio of statements that they could point to. And they essentially made this a one-on-one matchup between Newsom and Elder, and in California with this electorate, that's a bad matchup. He also benefited from, Newsom benefited from a bad poll, a poll by Survey USA, which is actually a good pollster nationally, but a pretty bad pollster in California for those who have seen it over the years. And that poll showed an even race, and that really agitated the liberal electorate to say, hey, we better pay attention to this. And they put together a very strong field campaign to actually contact voters and get them out. So I think those two things were the things that benefited Newsom.
Tim, what do Republicans think they're doing in this sort of race?
I think there was, it was kind of fun. Don't underestimate the degree to which politics these days is about trolling and doing that sort of thing. I'm sure there were consultants who made good money off of this, which is sort of a standard fare in both parties, where you run against Nancy Pelosi, or you Amy McGrath, you run against Mitch McConnell, you pretend you have a really good chance of winning, and your consultants make buck. But also, I think that there was an overestimation of how unpopular the sort of COVID lockdowns and the bad policies on that would be. And this is, I think, an important lesson that conservatives need to learn, is that in a lot of the countries, and not just in the most left-wing part, people are very scared, and they often tend to like closures. And a vaccine mandate will probably prove to be relatively popular for a mandate, when mandates in general are not. And so I think that the majority tends to be wrong in thinking that schools should be closed and thinking that, we need to mask up vaccinated people, et cetera. But that is where the majority is, and nobody's probably going to move them anytime soon.
David, I think that was, in theory, part of the theory of the recall, that you had certain certain people who were not in traditional Republican constituencies, but who worked in industries that had been significantly disrupted by the COVID pandemic, or who had aspects of their personal lives that have been significantly disrupted by the COVID pandemic, that they would be attracted to someone who would basically say, I'm going to stop all these rules that Gavin has imposed on you, adding, of course, the layer of him showing up at the French Laundry at the time that he was imposing these restrictions, which I think was irritating to everyone, including people who voted for him. But I think, you know, as Tim notes there, and I think probably especially with the rise of the Delta variant over the summer, that the balance of public opinion was toward the idea that actually the government, by imposing rules, was largely doing a good thing here.
Yeah, and I think that this recall served as kind of, as my colleague Harold Meyerson put it, an off-Broadway play that goes out and road tests some of the lines, and then goes back to Broadway to figure it out and get that information. This is a way for Democrats across the country to sort of test the ideas around vaccine mandates and how aggressive they can be in attacking Republicans on those particular issues. I also think it's actually going to be very powerful for the fact that Democrats were able to do off-year contacts with Democrats in swing districts in California, of which there are several. There are about six or seven. And when we have the midterm elections, that's going to be very helpful to maintain those contacts, to clean up their lists, and to ensure that those shaky Democrats in those particular districts, and also in those districts where Republicans won back seats in 2020, this is going to be helpful for the House in the midterm elections, and mainly for that reason. I think we got some more information about that. There are a lot of suburban districts out there in the country that have a similar makeup to the many suburban districts that there are in California, where the recall did very poorly, and Democrats are going to try to apply those lessons.
Tim, I wonder what you make of the lessons that Republicans are learning about this in other states, because I think the politics of the restrictions depends on exactly what restrictions we're talking about and what circumstance. And I know you're in Maryland, where I think the popular Republican governor, Larry Hogan, has pushed back on some things to, for example, help keep more schools open. And that strikes me not only as good policy, but good politics. But then you have like Ron DeSantis in Florida getting on stage this week with a vaccine refuser who claimed that, you know, the vaccine was going to change his RNA, which I think he meant DNA. The vaccine does not do that. But it seems like you have Ron DeSantis, Greg Abbott in Texas, various other Republican figures striking out these hardline anti-mandate positions, not just even for mandates that apply to the broad public, but that apply in specific employment settings. Ron DeSantis trying to stop the cruise lines from imposing a vaccine mandate to get on board a cruise ship, which is basically a petri dish. It seems to me like this is not only bad policy, it strikes me as crazy politics that is going to be bad for Republicans next year.
I think it does. I think the Republicans are captive a lot of times to a small, very aggressive base. And this used to be said about like conservatives, right? Like that ideologically, the Republican elected leaders were captured by, you know, crazy pro-lifers or crazy tax cutters. And I don't think it was ever true about ideology. The Republican Party was a big tent, but a lot of these state level leaders and congressional and congressmen and senators, for them, it's more of this kind of cultural right where, you know, there's a popularity to smacking down Austin or some liberal city or something that's doing something that we don't like, even though that's just sort of more culture war than policy. And so I do think that that's an issue. Now, I don't second guess Ron DeSantis' politics too much. I think he's been brilliant. He did a lot of things a lot of times he did good policies and got attacked by it. So he won points, like prioritizing old people and vaccines earlier this year and that sort of thing. So maybe we'll see that DeSantis comes out looking like a genius on this. But I tend to agree with you that on the policy and the politics, stuff like the cruise ship rule and the ban on mask mandates on a local level, I don't think those will prove to be popular.
David, to what extent do you think Democrats can plan to lean on this as we go into the midterm elections next year? I mean, Democrats have a lot of reasons to be nervous about the midterms. They are, first of all, they're the majority party defending, which tends to lose seats. You've seen a significant deterioration in President Biden's approval ratings over the course of the summer. You have redistricting going on. I think people are actually overstating the extent to which this round of redistricting is going to be negative for Democrats, but we're going to have to wait for the maps to come out to show that. But to what extent, if Democrats have figured out the better position on some of these issues, to what extent can that overcome other traditional disadvantages from being in the position they're in right now?
It's certainly possible, and I do think that this issue of safety certainly animates a lot of Democratic voters. Now, we don't know what the situation is going to be in the fall of 2022, which is going to be more determinative, I think, of whether you're going to be able to get voters out. You can't sort of backwards look and say, remember last year when we were not as safe, and now we had this, you know, and Republicans didn't want to impose these various mandates. You can certainly say if we are in a better position in the fall of 2022 that the vaccine mandates proposed by the Biden administration worked and that we got ourselves back to normal. I think return to normalcy will be one kind of campaign theme if that is the state of affairs at that time. But I really do think that these several districts in California, that the House elections are going to be so close next year that I do think it's going to be a matter of a few districts here and there. And the fact that Democrats were able to contact practically all their voters, I mean, there was a tremendous voter contact operation out here. The fact that they were able to do that a year before the election and that they can have a continuing conversation with those voters to get them out. And if they win three or four additional seats in California at the margins, that's a big number considering how close this election is going to be. So I think that's an underrated aspect of this.
That's the whole House majority right now.
It's exactly
close. Yeah. We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Tim Carney, it's your soapbox.
I hope everyone is enjoying their autumn. Everyone, that is, except for the pedants who insist that fall doesn't begin until September 22nd. You are perfectly free to choose the autumnal equinox as your marker for the end of summer, but quit trying to claim it's somehow the correct marker. There is no official first day of fall because there's no official who gets to blow the whistle to kick off fall or write the rule book on this. The four seasons are not a creation of God. They're the device of man used to explain the phenomena of God's creation. They're not ontological facts. They're explanatory tools. Astronomical seasons have many uses, but the astronomers are not our rulers. September 1st is a perfectly fine day to call the first day of fall. For me, because I have six kids at home, the first day of school is the beginning of fall. And if you got the astronomers and the pedants to be honest, they'll admit that even for them, the summer ended and fall began a few weeks ago. The NFL's on week two, college football's on week three, parts of the Rocky Mountains, Appalachia, New England, this weekend will be near peak foliage. So astronomers do great work. I'm grateful for them, but they don't make the rules and they don't get to tell us when the seasons begin.
High temperature in New York this Saturday will be 84 degrees. David Dayan, it's your rant.
Well, Friday is the 10th anniversary of Occupy Wall Street, and the media depiction of this movement is always about an inchoate mass of discontent that had no real ideas, no real specifics, no real ability to change the country to their liking. And yet, in 2011, when Occupy began, the Democratic Party's standard bearer was busy trying to figure out how to raise the Medicare eligibility age and cut spending in a grand bargain with Republicans. Today, the Democratic Party's standard bearer is trying really hard to spend trillions of dollars to give people universal pre-kindergarten and free community college and expanded health and child care and elder care benefits and a child tax credit that amounts to a universal basic income for children. I submit that this shift within democratic politics would not have been possible without a progressive movement that has shifted policy in its direction and that has direct linkages to Occupy. Occupy birthed the movement for fighting inequality, the movement for canceling student debt, the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign. Both of those were staffed by a lot of Occupy veterans, which brought the idea of big grassroots organizing into those campaigns. Occupy also put into stark relief how local police departments crushed dissent and gave rise to further scrutiny of police brutality. So the image is of a bunch of angry people with signs and slogans. The reality is that Occupy changed politics in the United States, and I'd say for the better.
For my rant, one postscript on the California recall. About half of voters did not vote on the second question in the recall, which was who should be governor if Gavin Newsom is removed. This was the Democratic strategy. We're not countenancing the recall. We're not putting up a candidate. Don't vote on the second question. And with the recall, with the no vote so far ahead in the end, it sort of made sense. It was going to fail. There was no need to vote on the second question. But a lot of people have been doing violence to the statistics by saying that Larry Elder got about 47% of the vote on recall question two. Now, he got about 47% of the people who voted on question two. But again, that's only something like half the voter universe. In fact, he got somewhere in the mid-20s in line with his polls. He did not overperform the polls. He is not necessarily the future of the California GOP, and he certainly did not get very close to getting 50%. So make sure if anybody shows you that statistic, it's shown up in the Washington Post this week, it's shown up on CNN, that's a misleading statistic. Larry Elder really is somewhere closer to the support of a quarter of California voters, which is to say nowhere near being the sort of candidate who can appeal statewide. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Tim Carney, David Dayan, and Dr. Peter Chin Hong. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our production fellow is Nisha Venkat. This show is recorded and mixed by Desmond Taylor and Nick Lamponi. And Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more of Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.